You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Hello, I'm Rosie Bennett. I'm the social affairs correspondent on The Times. And in March this year, we launched a campaign, Time to Mind, on children's mental health to raise the profile of the problem predominantly, but also to really ask government for more resources to be invested in treatment and preventative services for young people. So we managed a story every day for about 3.5 weeks before we kind of totally ran out of steam, but we're regrouping and we'll be back after the election. So that's why I'm here. And we were motivated to act probably for the same reasons as Channel 4 and Ali. We've known for some time that the mental health of young people is deteriorating for many reasons, but nothing is being done about it. And I'm always struck when I'm a parent myself, and I'm always struck when I'm with other parents who have teenage children, how soon the conversation turns to mental health. It really is everyone's greatest fear that their child is going to be struck down with anorexia or depression or anxiety. So everywhere there is evidence that young people are suffering, yet the resources dedicated to it are really paltry, as your documentary explained. In fact, Peter Wanless, the head of the NSPCC, recently called it willful child neglect, and I'm inclined to agree with him. We have, as well as Ali, we have three experts in the field. I'm going to ask them to introduce themselves, if that's all right, and just say why they are here. So do you want to, you can go first.
Me?
Yeah.
Okay. What do you want me to talk about?
Just your documentary you've done in the past.
I suppose a lot of my work is quite sensitive. Mm. So I suppose the films I've made along the way, I spend a lot of time. I drink a lot of tea with people for a long time to the point that people often go, are you actually going to film me one of these days because I've drunk so much tea? And then they go, right. So I believe that 75% of my work would be talking to people, Jane and Paul are not in the audience, and then trying to work out what we're going to do together.
Yeah.
Because I take a lot, I'll be listening to the families and the people I'm working with. In the past, I've made a film in Belfast about a rape crisis centre. It was the first quite tough film I'd made where they were shutting the centre down, and it was quite a challenging one to work with the people who were coming there. And then I made a film with Dara McIntyre about, and with Sam Collins is here somewhere, about clerical abuse in the Catholic Church in Ireland, which was also really challenging because some of the boys hadn't spoken before. Yeah. And there's a lot of stigma attached to a lot of these stories that are really sensitive, and people need to be... it's hard because it's hard to get it right, and you have a massive duty of care and all those things. So I suppose whenever I started talking to Siobhan about this film, I've got many friends with children, and one of my children's, struggles with various things as well. So I just immediately had read the headlines, and there was a lot of stuff in the papers about it, but it wasn't until I started to meet the people and the families. The headlines didn't really sink in until I could see. When you read about X amount of miles, when you go, right, that's terrible. But when you see how that, your entire life changes, and I can't bear to think of sending my 13-year-old or 14-year-old 200 miles. I just don't know. How it would work. So I think once I started meeting people, I think Gillian and I were on the road for quite a while meeting families and all over the country, that was quite soon the picture was pretty horrific, really. And then when I met Liz, I was saying, could this really be right? Am I getting something wrong? And she was going, no, actually, that is really what's happening. They're really the effects of cuts and the lack of particularly the tier 4 beds and the system where, the children were a bit like parcels. They were just being sent sort of here and then. I couldn't really get my head around it.
Yes.
So I suppose that was that. And then getting people who were really willing to, and the young people as well, to consent as well, who were also willing for their stories to be told. So that's all a challenge, and it's, an ongoing challenge because you do want to make sure they're well and, they're always managing. So that was a challenge too. So am I ready for a very gentle film about gardening next? Yes.
Yeah.
Just for 1 minute, but then.
Okay. Lisa, do you want to introduce yourself? And
thank you. Yes. So my name's Lisa Rodriguez. I've had a career in three sections, really. I was a children's nurse and a health visitor for the first third of my career. Second third, I was in NHS management, including 13 years running mental health services. I was a chief executive. Now I'm in my third career. I'm a writer and a mental health campaigner. And I'm so pleased to be here this evening. And I'm a little overwhelmed, actually, to see three people who were in that beautiful film. And thank you so much for what you did, because it is an utter disgrace, in my view, that we have services that are not meeting the needs of children and young people. And we need to make as much noise about it as possible. So that's what I'm doing these days. I'm a little bit let loose. And perhaps I've also got a personal interest, because I first saw a psychiatrist myself when I was 15. But I didn't have the courage to start talking about that until about 18 months ago. And I'm now very happy to talk about it, because I want to explain to people that people who have mental illnesses look just like me, and just like one in four of you, some of you in the audience here. And all we need is a little bit of extra help occasionally, and we can do great things. So I want to change the world, and I hope we're going to talk about how we're going to do that this evening.
Very good. Peter?
I suppose I come here with two different hats on. I'm a jobbing child nurse and psychiatrist. I work at St Thomas's Hospital, and I work in an acute setting. So part of my work is assessing young people who presented in crisis. I've talked to young people about how we may have to find a bed at a long distance and have to have very difficult conversations with them and their families about what that means, and also very conscious of the way in which services have changed over the last 5 years, and the way in which services, I think not just in mental health but in social care and education that were previously around, that I think kind of absorbed a lot of the difficulties that young people faced, and so helped to avoid crisis and helped to avoid the need for inpatient care. And I suppose as a child nurse and psychiatrist, I try my utmost to avoid admission, because I think I would fully agree with the family members that, you know, you want your kids to be with their family members and in their local communities and with their friends and in their schools. And so you don't consider admission until you really feel it's the only last resort you've got. So I suppose I come with that hat on, and like Lisa, I wanted to thank the families and the filmmakers, because I thought it was a really beautiful film, and it touched on some very, very complicated issues in a very thoughtful and really very helpful way. Mm. And so I suppose my other hat is as chair of the Faculty of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry in the Royal College, and we've been drawing information from our members, really trying to highlight the crisis that the film brings to, in such a personal way. We've tried to pull together some of the statistics, some of the data, not just around the difficulties in terms of admissions to hospital, but also the difficulties around the sorts of services that should be around to support children to avoid admission. I hope that the new money has been announced is genuinely new money, but I think we have a responsibility to absolutely ensure that is new money and that it's well spent and it's appropriately spent to help to avoid the sort of very difficult circumstances that we've heard
not
about
just being taken from some other budget.
Yeah, that's
Lucy, do you want to, Lucy's from Young Minds, which is a fantastic charity, but you can tell people about it better than I.
I'm Director of Campaigns and Media at Young Minds. I've been a campaigner for about 25 years. And my background was homelessness and then criminal justice, and then I moved into mental health in terms of campaigning. So I've been at Young Minds for, I think, about 7 years, and when I started, nobody talked about this. And I walked in, and you know, my responsibility was to get media for this absolutely vital cause. Nobody wanted to go anywhere near it. Over the years, organisations like us and the Royal College of Psychiatrists and everyone who's an activist has been really putting a lot of effort into getting these people's voices out there. And what this documentary does is it takes it into the mainstream. So we meet politicians all the time, and we talk to possibly the broadsheets who may be more interested. Something like this, it's dispatches, it's fantastic. You know, this is what needs to start happening, and it is. I mean, in terms of interest in this area, it's absolutely exploded, and your manifesto has really made a big difference. I think it's you know, a beautifully made film. It's very, very touching. And young people are under incredible pressure. Some of those pressures are unprecedented in our society. CAMHS has been, or Children and Young People's Mental Health Services, have been in crisis for years. There was a review in 2008, you know, and some things have changed, but it's still, you know, as you've shown from the film so beautifully, things are, you know, really, really bad. There is money that has been put to this. The government have just undertaken a review of services, and that review is called Future in Mind, and their local areas are having to take on what's called transformation plans. So things are moving, but this is all about what happens with the next government. Mm. And, you know, I think we're at a tipping point here, and we really need to keep pushing. We've got to keep pushing, because otherwise it could go under the carpet again.
Yes,
and we cannot let that happen again.
Yeah, thank you. The thing that really stood out for me was the feelings of parents in this, and how absolutely appalling it is to have an ill child and then have an ill child that's 300 miles away. Yeah. Did you set out to focus on parents?
Yeah, we did.
Or you did, yeah. Right.
I think we discussed, I think I met with Siobhan at the beginning, and having met the families, I found that when, I think myself, Rory, Julie and the team were meeting people all over the country, we were finding the same thing. Parents who we talk about, and they were very alone, and they felt really they didn't know who to talk to. They were really struggling themselves and getting ill themselves because of the pressure, because of the journey. I mean, not everyone, but, you know, people we met, we found. And we actually, I remember we sat down, we talked about it, and I said, parents are really struggling with this. I mean, and how would you feel? And I kept thinking to myself, how would I feel? So I kept, so we did make a decision to go that direction, yeah. But it was, you know, and I suppose it really is that thing. I often do try and think about that position myself, but I just couldn't imagine it. Any of my children being so far away and so ill, you want to be with them and give them a cuddle when they're sick and see them, or even if there was units or places nearby, even if you had to drive a bit, you know, for Northern Ireland, there's one in the whole island.
Yes.
You know.
It's still
or,
not so far away.
It's not so far away, but I mean, Cornwall's the same. It's a long way to go. Too far.
And absolutely. Your statistic that you said about placing 10 young people out of area costs around £3 million, which is the cost of a local unit. That was so powerful. That was really...
Well, there's been discussions about that in Cornwall, haven't there, Liz, about, you know, about the price and...
Yeah, but we're really passionate in Cornwall and have been working with a local charity, the Victor's Trust, to try and get a unit that would actually go up to age 19-20 or more, to cross that divide so that we don't have to send people somewhere else. But so far we're a little bit stalled on that because we're waiting for NHS England.
I think that's one of the things that we need to draw out is that I mean, this crisis arose out of a whole series of very complicated factors, but probably one of the elements has been the change in commissioning of beds, because previously beds were commissioned in such a way that in some places you could have very effective arrangements between local child adolescent mental health services and the inpatient units that would allow what we call risk sharing, so that you could find a way of supporting services that could either prevent admission or shorten admission. And when commission was taken away into NHS England, all of those incentives were removed. And so a lot of those arrangements broke down. And one of the things that will come out of, what has come out of Future in Mind, is trying to work out how to get the current commissioning process to work in a way that allows you to provide flexible services and allows you to provide those kind of seamless services that children and young people need.
Yeah.
I mean, there is actually a review of Tier 4 services, our inpatient services, and there has been a government review of them and an action plan created. But from what we can see, it is not really making yet. It doesn't seem to be, because as Peter said, it's structural, isn't it? Some of the problems are structural, aren't they?
Are you aware, is Cornwall particularly badly off?
Well, it is. In fact, in the Tier 4 review, it wasn't on the map, which says it all, unfortunately.
Yes.
But because our nearest unit, and I'm looking at the west of Cornwall, is 80 miles away in another county, which is actually a really big thing.
Yeah.
So you're actually going from a county. And of course, we can't live in the country, as Paul would say.
Yes.
But the southwest as a whole, was identified as being particularly poorly off. But if we then consider the options the further out you go.
Yes.
I've got a girl from the Isles of Scilly who, thankfully, I managed to get into a Plymouth unit, but that would take the parents all day to get there.
Yes. Even though, yes, it doesn't sound too bad. And can I ask you, as a clinician, what is it like for a young... You know, by the time a young person's admitted to hospital, they're in quite a serious state of distress. What is it like then for them to have to go so far from home and to such an unfamiliar environment?
There's two things. One is that when you start to broach the subject of admission, you often don't know where... You're suggesting that the young person
will
be admitted.
Because, you know,
what you, yes, exactly. Yeah. It's what you want. You need, you know, with everybody, but particularly with children and young people, you need to keep things concrete. You know, you need to look, this is the place, be able
this
to...
This is what it looks like.
This is what it looks yeah. like. This is what mm. it's going to be like. These are some of the rules around the place, you know. And previously it was more easy to do that because I knew all of the inpatient units in South London and I knew the clinicians and I could have a fairly
a really
good...
Nice
yeah, I
ex,
know this. Yeah. yeah, I know this, etc. Whereas now, I can't say that. I can say, look, we're looking for a bed, we don't know where it is, we'll tell you as soon as we can. And that's very distressing for the young people, it's very distressing for the families, because there's a huge... I mean, I don't think any parent thinks lightly about the idea of their child being admitted to an inpatient unit, as the parents so movingly described. You know, I've got three kids, they're all grown up now, but, you know, the last thing you want is to be away from them at a point where they're in great distress.
Yes.
So it makes it more difficult. And I suppose the other side of it is just thinking about how unique you want units, inpatient units, to have the right staff with the right skills, the right training, and that creates great difficulties.
Yes.
And also, you know, you need to think about how different areas will have things organised in a different way. Cornwall's a very different place from. I work in Lambeth. Yeah, they're like chalk and cheese.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So you have to, and I think maybe one of the good things that will come out of Future in Mind is the idea that each area has to produce a transformation plan, which will be very much in conjunction with all the people who should be involved in ensuring young people's mental health, not just health, but education and social care and the voluntary sector. And you're bringing everybody together to try and create. Yeah. an effective local solution, but it needs more money, you know, and I think that has to be absolutely clear that this is a system which was starved before the cuts.
Before the cuts,
now it's on, exactly.
Could I ask, I don't mean to put you on the spot, but I just could ask Chloe's parents here, how did she cope with being so far from home? And she's on her fourth placement, is that correct?
And then she was moved to the Nidge, Stevenage. Then she went to Colchester.
Yeah.
Got a bit better and then came back to Kent. But the effect of it means that she's obviously got limited... We can't see her all the time when we want to, but it means that all their family members... She's completely cut off from every other family member, especially her brother Josh.
Mm.
Because we can't get him up. She's completely lost all her friends she grew up with, her schoolmates, you know, cricketing buddies. They're all gone. It's complete and utter exile. It's almost sort of medieval banishment, if you like.
Yes. Do you want to come in?
Yes. It is medieval and. People have been very gentle in their language. This is a disgrace. It really is a disgrace. And when the announcements were made, it was about a month ago, wasn't it, that should the coalition get in next time, they will make these investments, etc. I think we've got to make more noise about this. You know, actually, we could sort this out really quite quickly. It does need money. It needs new money. But it also needs us to start treating children, young people, as though they really mattered. Because actually, it isn't about... hospitals. It's about the care that most people need to have around the community. I'm not saying your daughter doesn't need to be in hospital. Clearly, she's very, very unwell. But actually, if there were better services and more expensive services running 24/7 that met the needs of people where you live, it might be that some of those young people that we saw in the film wouldn't have had to go to hospital in the first place. And that would mean then we'd have more hospital spaces for those who really did need to go to hospital. So the whole thing would cost us less money and be more effective, and it would mean that children, you're talking about your daughter losing contact with family and school and friends and so on, that if she were more local to you, you would have been able to maintain those contacts with her, and that would have actually helped her get better more quickly. So I think we have to really make a very strong business case for this. But I also think that somehow in the NHS we've got a system where we set one bit of the system up against another. You know, I speak as somebody who's been involved in competitive tendering and in the past as a chief executive, been successful, been really pleased when we've won something. But that means somebody else has lost. And this should not be the case. It's not right that we should be setting one part of the system up against another. There were services being shown in that film that were private services. There were services that were NHS services. We should all be working together. It shouldn't be social care good, NHS care bad. It shouldn't be that the families need to know which services are provided by whom. That should be something that we make as simple as possible. And we, I'm talking about people who've got responsibility. I don't know. I'm just making a fuss about those that do. But I produced an 8-point plan for NHS England, the things they could do. It would be very straightforward, but the most important one is to put children and young people first. And if we do that, then everything else follows. You know, if these were cancer services, we were saying earlier, people would be out on the streets campaigning to say you have to wait until you're so ill that you would need care that meant you had to go hundreds of miles away. People wouldn't accept it. We need to make the same fuss for our children, young people, because they are the future. I know everybody here is converted because you wouldn't be here otherwise, but we need to tell everybody else that this really matters. And I think if the public know it, the wonderful thing about your film, Alison, is that more people are going to see it. As you're saying, it's going to be in the mainstream. We need to make sure people see this and understand it and see that it's an investment we cannot afford not to make. It's not a choice. It's something we must do, or it's going to cost us so, so much more dearly, not just for individuals like yourselves and your family, but for the whole of society.
And just to add to that, you know, you're absolutely right. The answer isn't just more beds. You know, one of the problems is that early intervention services, so that's counselling services on the high street and voluntary organisations and services in schools, and helplines have all just been decimated because of austerity measures. So what it means, as you say, is you have to end up with a crisis before you get the help that you need. This is awful, perverse incentive now, that you have to get more and more ill to get what you need. And as you said, it doesn't mean, you know, your child didn't need a bed, but it's not as simplistic as just more beds.
If anyone would like to answer a question, could you stick your hand up so I can... carry on.
We just about to add that it's across the whole sector, because it's also the specialist services, which have been cut very significantly. The whole thing has been decimated.
Indeed, yeah. There was a lady there. Thank you.
Just to say, I'm Sylvia, and I have personal experience from through family and friends of CAMHS. Just two little questions, really. Any idea when this programme is likely to be transmitted? And secondly, during the film, there was mention of the cost the tab being picked up by the NHS for staff to travel to keep an eye on their patients. What financial help, if any, is available to the parents?
What's available to parents? I think it varies from place to place, doesn't it? I'm not really sure, actually. It does vary what you can get.
We get our fuel costs, but we have to fund all the other expenses. So hotels, have to stay overnight. Mm. And I think Alison's found families that have stayed in cars because they can't afford...
I found families who don't have the money. Or, Liz, as we know, there are some who can't. I mean, you would know...
Well, unfortunately, because our local clinical commissioning group says, well, it's not our commission service, we're not paying, and NHS England says, well, sorry, we don't see that family visits is part of the treatment package, so we're not paying. So actually what's happened in Cornwall is a local charity has raised funds to help out, but it still only goes a small way. And we do have some families who actually cannot go and visit their children because of money.
Yeah. We're not 100% sure when it will go out. We're still finishing the film. I mean, I think it will be after the election. I think we're very keen that it really is a card that lands at the door of whatever administration comes in next, whoever that may be, to say that this is an issue that you need to put on your radar. So TBC, I'm afraid, just at the moment, but soon, hopefully.
Just before I take another question, the subject of family visits and being good, bad, or whatever, I was really shocked by the, was it Emily's parents, when she turned 18, the family were sort of told that they were getting in the way of the treatment, whatever. Is that normal?
There's a very significant cultural difference between child and adult mental health service and adult mental health services. I think, as a CAMHS professional, I'd see parents as a key collaborator, people you want to work very closely with, because they know their child best. Mm. In a lot of adult mental health services, parents are regarded as enemies, I think. But I think there's a change. There's a big shift towards starting to develop service models for 0 to 25.
Right.
And that's meant that child and adolescent psychiatrists and adult psychiatrists have had to sit down and talk to each other. So I chair a working party in the Royal College between child and adolescent psychiatrists and adult psychiatrists. And I think what's starting to happen is that amongst some adult psychiatrists, there's a shift, that they're starting to recognise that actually parents are people you have to work really closely with. They have the best interests of their children at heart, and they're a really, really important resource. So I think things are shifting, but...
I find that one an interesting one, because it does vary a lot, I find, in my experience of the film, and certainly with Chris and Katie. I think because it just happened, the transition with Emily, 4 months now, I think it is in total, they absolutely had such incredible support in Wisteria. Just couldn't believe how much support they had. And they were involved and they could ask questions, and there was actually support groups, and the parents were very included. And then I think this was just called, well, she's a bit older now, she has to learn to stand on 2 feet. Overnight, they said literally 18 plus one, and Emily was an adult. Mm-hmm. And that if she'd gone to university, she still probably could open a tin of beans or do whatever, but they always joke and say, she's actually really ill and not managing at all. And she's so far away, so they're finding that really... They've been through a lot, as you can tell, but it's not great.
I'm not arguing that everything is rosy, but yeah. I think there's a legal issue that when you reach 18, you
That's
have
right.
to move
yes.
out
You're
of
an
it,
adult, yeah.
And it affects lots of different people in a very adverse way.
Decisions about your care.
But also, units with people under 18 can't have people over 18 on the same unit.
Premises.
Yeah. So there's a ridiculous legal issue.
There's just things I didn't know, sorry, Lisa, that things that I know, maybe you would read an article, but until you live it or you live it through the families and you see it, I didn't realise that, he was really quite upset that he hadn't been to Emily's room. There's things that are really, and other families, and even in our research, we found it really alarming that their children are in somewhere and they can't see where they are, where they stay, what it looks like. They have a picture on the wall. Just things that would comfort them greatly are just not... It's not happening. And I think small things like that are big things.
Well,
and they would really...
Well, that's the normal relationship, isn't it? To know what your child's bedroom looks like
absolutely.
When they are 18. So it's...
And even with the younger ones, I think, that I filmed, and people I'd met, I think it was that thing of just the comfort of the parents. Even knowing... I mean, it's a quite... When you go to some of the inpatient units, it is quite... There are big walls and fences, and it's... quite frightening experience. And I think for the parents too, to even be stepped through that, say you are here and it's different. And I know it's not easy, but there's a lot of things could make it a bit better.
It.
I think
a
so.
Bit, yeah.
Do you think?
There's a cultural change that needs to happen in mental health services. And I think that's exactly what was being described in that film, that the people who worked in that service had not gone through that cultural change. I'll just say something personal for a moment. When I last had depression, when I was 58, the people who were the most important to me were my husband, my two grown-up children, and my mum, who's now 86. And, parents matter throughout your life, and it's really important that they're included. And what we used to say to our staff was, these people love their family member. We have to find a way around the Mental Health Act so they can be included in whatever way possible. So, you know, I'm prepared to go out on a limb and say it looked wrong to me. Now, whether it was right or not, I don't know, but it looked wrong to me from where I was sitting.
Should we take a couple of questions, actually? A chap here and there, and then I'll come over here.
James McDade from the College of Occupational Therapists. Two questions. Firstly, the rise of children's mental health issues, is there a rise generally, or is there a better identification? And secondly, it was touched upon within the film, sometimes the police were called or were advised to be called in situations. Was there any interviews with the police and how they had to deal with children in that situation and the lack of training within that? Because I assume most police officers haven't dealt with children that way or can't deal very well.
Hi, Peter Hudson. I work in the mental health sector and I've been a service user most of my life for mental health. We've talked a bit about, or rather you've talked about austerity, and it does seem to be the like the sort of Damocles hanging over everything. There's a huge amount of uncertainty over, you know, who's actually going to lead the country. And I find it very scary, as I think probably most people do, if they're really honest. It's quite terrifying, actually. So many politicians aren't owning up to what's going to be spent and so on. Not that I'm trying to look at things as a worst-case scenario, but, you know, where should the mental health sector, the press, campaigners, lobbyists and so on, where should they focus the pressure? What should the priorities be? It seems that things have changed. It's not it used to be you just focused on the ministers, you focused on the government, but that seems to have changed now. And I used to work with the Health and Wellbeing Board, and I had to say it was chaos. People were sort of passing the buck left, right and centre.
Okay, thank you. Right, well, let's spread the load. Did you speak to the police at all?
We did.
Yeah?
Rory, quite a lot. And especially, I don't know if you guys remember, there was a story that broke in... Wasn't it? It was in Devon, that story
yes,
that
was.
Broke on Sky.
Yes, yes.
And we did speak a lot down there. There's a really fantastic man we were speaking to, Mark Bolt, down in Cornwall, who's just wonderful and... We talked about doing some work with him, but actually at the time, let's just say it was a bit delicate because of, and not from the police's point, I think there was an interesting debate as to the role of police, and we were advised it probably would be better to maybe talk to them when thing in a bit as time passed, because there was a debate as to what are they going to do, because the police are like going, we can't manage, and this is not our job, and we're not qualified, and blah, blah, blah. And even though they're embracing it, like Mark's amazing, isn't he? And he's embracing it. They're really incredible what they're doing. But I think the Devon sort of situation had broken, and he was incredible for speaking. And the police all around were, you know, he did say, didn't he, that he went to a police conference, Rory, and people had said, thank goodness, you spoke out, thank goodness. But that's a bit of a... ongoing issue yet as to what their role is.
Yes,
so we did speak to, and I think the story that particularly broke down with you guys was the girl who she was then moved, she's been moved three times already, that wee girl, the girl who was moved and who was in the police cell.
Yeah.
She's already in her third move already, yes. to a different place. But no, I did speak to them, and I wasn't going to include them. I think it was
from my work on the Times, if it's enlightening at all, we and the cases we cover, when there's an emergency, everyone runs for cover, and so the police are the last ones standing that have to actually take responsibility. And also, there's so few places of designated places of safety that a cell is often the only one.
Yeah.
Does someone want to hop in on prevalence?
Yeah, I can pick that up. The answer we don't know, because there hasn't been a national prevalence study since 2004. Another prevalence study has been commissioned, but there's still some debate about exactly what that will do. There was a paper published a couple of weeks ago by Miranda Wolpert's group, which was a study of secondary school children, which suggested that between 2009 and 2014, amongst girls, the prevalence of mental health problems had gone up by about over half, 55%. There's some problems with the study because it's a questionnaire-based study. There are no diagnostic interviews with young people, so all you can say is that the risk. From a sort of clinical perspective, I would say it does appear so. And probably the two main factors are social media. I don't think we really understand the impact of social media on young people's lives. You know, in many ways, it's a great thing, and you know, lots of my patients and young people I know benefit from it hugely. But I've heard people talk about how social media are, in effect, the playground 24 hours a day. So in my day, which is a long time ago, you know, if I was bullied at school, I could get home, I could escape it. Whereas now, if you get bullied at school, that doesn't go away. It carries on 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And I think that's a fact we really don't understand. Mm-hmm. And the other issue that we know is that in times of austerity, mental health problems increase in prevalence. And, you know, if parents come under stress, if families come under stress as they do during periods of austerity, then children come under stress.
I was going to ask you, Lucy, if you could pick up on where are the best points to push as a campaigner? Ministers? Is it someone that...
I just want to add to a couple of things with the police. The police don't want to have young people in their cells. As you say, it's because there's a lack of appropriate places of safety for under-18s. And And the Home Secretary said recently this has to be a never event that this happens. But if there aren't appropriate places of safety, then... Exactly. So I think, in terms of the pressures children and young people are under, I completely agree with Peter. I think that social media, young people live their lives in the public domain. There is no privacy. They need constant reassurance from each other all the time, and they have to build this brand me, you know, we often talk about. And that's why I referred earlier to some of these issues are unprecedented. This one is unprecedented, as is stress at school, I think, as well. But in terms of where to push as a campaigner for any of us, I think I don't think it is just about the government. You know, I don't think the government is going to be able to solve this. You know, as Lisa has said, this is down to local areas, and this is down to everyone involved in local areas, and everybody taking a strategic approach and seeing it as their problem. You know, as we know, you know, people, groups, organisations, services work in silos, and mental health touches so many different areas. You know, when we're looking at what needs to be done, it is about schools, it is about frontline services like youth services, it is about inpatient services and psychiatrists in areas, and so everybody working together. So I think it is about, the crisis, if you want to do something, there's one thing you can do. The Crisis Care Concord app was set up, it's run by Mind, and you can see a map of every area in the country and the declarations they've signed up to around dealing with people in crisis care. You can write to everyone in the area, the people who've signed the declaration in your area, and say, what are you doing about this? You know, I want to see evidence of what you're doing and how you are meeting your targets. I mean, that's one particular thing you can do. But, you know, government-wise, you know, we will be going to whoever gets into government and saying, you know, as Lisa's saying, you know, you've committed this money for 5 years, but money isn't enough. That takes the budget from 6% to, I think, about 7 or 8%. We worked it out, so it's still it's paltry.
Just a couple of points.
Okay, very quick.
Just crisis care. We mustn't forget social care because a child in crisis is often a family in crisis, and that's the bit that I think the Crisis Care Concord Act really hasn't seen. They've missed that. It's a crucial component of it.
Hi, I'm Stella. I'm 17. I'm a service user in CAMHS. And I really want to say that this is really important, and it's so true that you don't understand until it affects you. I spent a lot of time in inpatient units. And today I was basically told that there were no local beds for me, and should I need a bed tomorrow, I would be going to Sheffield or something. I live in London. I live in South London, which is a bit ridiculous. And I was like, really? And and it's just such a big issue, and it's so important that we're actually talking about it. Because, I mean, even when I came into CAMHS when I was 13, I don't think I ever heard about it on the news. I don't think anyone spoke about mental health. So I think that it has come a long way, even, like, especially with my peers and stuff, people my age, a lot of people are now talking about mental health. And also, on the point of the police, just these are just statements, these aren't really questions for anyone in particular. On the point of the police, I think that the police are really picking up the pieces of sort of the lack of 24-hour crisis care and healthcare and social care as well. those budgets have been completely decimated, and that's really now why the police are playing an ever more important role in crisis care and why we're relying on them so much more than we have been in the past.
Thank you very much. Lady there.
Hi, my name's Chloe. I'm from Carers Trust. I wanted to thank you first for the film. It's really powerful and really conveys a lot of the complicated issues that families are facing. I wanted to pick up on the portrayal of the difficult issues when the young person moved from being officially a child to officially an adult, a transition, and how that affected the parents. It's really, you could see the difficult position they were put in and how much of a contradiction it was that they went from being the people who were worked with to being pushed away and almost blamed potentially. So I wanted to just raise the issue of them as carers once the parent carers in a way when the child turns 18, and how important it is that carers are respected for their role and that they have the information to support themselves because they're going through a difficult circumstance.
Hello, Romy Shovelton. I work on a young people's project for very disturbed young teenagers. I was interested, Dr. Hindley, you said about the Future in Mind review that every area has to create a transformation plan. And you also talked about there being other reviews and plans being made. And Lucy, you sort of said, well, you know, what's happened to them? I'm just wondering who is going to be involved and how are we going to get some sort of sense that something will actually come out of it and then be actioned? Because I also do a lot of helping organisations to plan the future and come together and all that sort of thing. That's fine to have the conversations, but you've got to be really clear before you start it that somebody's going to stump up something or other to make it happen. And you seemed as if you were quite encouraged by it. So I was really wondering who's going to do that and make it happen.
Okay, I'll take the question. Lisa, I think you wanted to speak to... Sorry, I missed your name. Stella, thank you very much for coming and speaking out. And I just... Sometimes this is a very depressing area to cover, but I really do believe there's been progress on stigma and raising the profile of this. So thank you, and people like you help enormously.
Well, so, that's what I want to know. So I know Stella from Twitter. We talk to each other, and she also writes a beautiful blog, which I've referred to in things that I've written. And she's taught me a few things. She's 17. The future is actually incredibly bright because of young people like you and thousands and thousands of others who are able to speak about their own experiences but are going to go on and run the country for us. So, you know, let's feel positive about that. But let's also recognise that what you've said, which is that you need help, like I did and still do on occasions, let's make sure that we do get together and make sure we make a fuss. It isn't about the government. It's about talking to each other and saying, we want these services to be resourced in the right way. And that's not a choice between this or that. It's this really does need to be resourced. So we need to do the campaigning.
Yes.
But I did want to say something because, you know, fantastic. Thank you so much for speaking.
Thank you very much. And just before we get into reviews and all that, I mean, you make a really valid point that that Emily's parents are actually going to be her carers when she leaves hospital. And so what is the point in leaving them outside?
Absolutely.
So, I mean, I must say, as a journalist, my eyes kind of glaze over when people start talking about task forces and reviews and concordats. And, so I suppose, how do we stop the talking and actually get someone who's responsible?
One thing is keeping it local, because it's CCGs and health and wellbeing boards that are going to be the key drivers. So it's your local communities you've really got to be working with. My wife always accuses me of toxic optimism. I think there are some things which are very different about Future in Mind. Yeah. First thing is it has probably the biggest sign up from the widest number of groups than any previous report and review. So you've had young people, carers, every single sector involved. And the other thing which I think is really important is that this isn't just a Department of Health review, this is an NHS England review. And NHS England will still be there after the next election. Whatever happens, it'll be there in some form. And the senior leadership within NHS England really see this as a crucial issue that has to be addressed. So I think there are some grounds for optimism. The thing that I think we really have to watch out for is how much is the new money smoke and mirrors? Because governments have a really, really uncanny knack of creating new bits of money which turn out to be actually old bits of money.
And they were very clear where this money was coming from.
So I think that's the one thing. That's the thing we've really got to... Talking about the manifesto that I was part of, I think we've really got to find a way of holding people to account for that new money.
Can I just add something as well about the local transformation plans, which I think is crucial. Sorry, I've got the wording here. The incentive is about money. So the money will come to those local areas who publish their transformation plans and actions for implementation. Local commissioners must give an annual declaration of investment and needs, and service providers must give an account of what services they provide, number of staff, waiting times and access to information. So the money won't come unless those things are happening. Now, that is better than vague, isn't it? And I know it's not perfect.
The other key thing is access and waiting times. So the big driver in physical healthcare was access and waiting times, and access and waiting times are now going to apply to mental health. Yeah. That's a really, really important driver.
Well, since we are just running out of time, I'm going to end by, given we are moving into talking about targets, the government talking about targets with mental health, if you were all to set one discrete target, what would it be? Lisa?
I don't think anybody who needs help with their mental health should have to wait the length of time that people currently have to wait. So I would say a maximum of 4 weeks for absolutely everything, but a reduced target underneath that for people who are more urgent or in an emergency. So, you know, within the same day an emergency, within a couple of days urgent, within 4 weeks for all other care in mental health services. I think that would change things radically.
Was there anything that you came across making the documentary that you thought that one thing would really help? That one thing?
Well, I suppose it's one thing we've talked about, and that is a place where parents could get to speak more, joining them all up together more. And I know Jane has talked to me a lot about that. You know, and the other families, even families that I met in the research, they feel very alone a lot of the time, and to be able to share things, and even sharing knowledge or sharing, well, actually, you know, this could happen, or do you know your rights with this?
Yes.
Or, you know, really not feel so alone, scattered all over the country, because this is a, you know, for my families, I'm really grateful for all of them. I mean, even ones who aren't in the clips tonight and things, so just all the people I've met and the research, everything, you know, are really, really brilliant. And the young people who all together wanted to do this film because they want to take, get rid of the stigma and really talk about, it's our well-being, it's everyday life, isn't it, Lisa? I mean, it's how you feel every day when you get out, do you, how we live. And I think the thing about you, particularly, Jane, had said, I would love to, you know, start somewhere we could bring families together. The parents feel lonely a lot of the time, and they could do a lot more together and help each other more, but if they could do that, it'd be great.
Very good. No jargon.
we've just surveyed our membership about urgent care pathways, and 35% of the respondents said there wasn't an urgent care pathway in the area they were working. So my target, I think there should be an urgent care pathway in every area of the country, because adult mental health have that. We need the same for young people. We need proper crisis care services for young people.
Okay.
Sorry, I just wanted to say, we have a parents' helpline, but it's absolutely overwhelmed with demand, but we do have one. Can I say two things?
That's so typical of a campaigner, isn't it?
Absolutely, sorry. We've got to find how we can build the resilience of children and young people across the board, because they are really, really under pressure and struggling. And I think we need access 24/7 online and on the high street to services that aren't intimidating, that young people just feel they can walk into, get the help they need when they need it.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, therSA.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.